One of my favorite guests we have on Let's Get Legal is a law professor at Southern Illinois University, Cindy Byes. She joins us again today. Professor, it's always a thrill to talk with you.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
You do such a great job trying to simplify what is often a complicated world of immigration law. And I was watching the Republican debate the other night, and of course immigration comes up. It should. We have a lot of issues regarding immigration, the southern border, et cetera, et cetera. We're not here to have a political discussion today, but it led me to the question of, like, immigration law. Who has the power to do what, president or the Congress? And I went right to my Constitution, and, well, it's a digital version of it, Cindy, so I can search it easy. And I entered Control F, right, when you want to search for a word, and I put in immigration, and it didn't pop up with anything. In fact, the Constitution leaves us a little blind in terms of immigration law, right?
That's exactly right. The word immigration does not appear in the U.S. Constitution.
And I did see Article 1, Section 8, Clause 4, that the Congress shall have power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. But that doesn't give us much of anything, although I guess it does put some of the power of naturalization in Congress. But it doesn't really answer any of the big questions of today, does it?
No, and you're right. Congress absolutely has the power to establish rules for naturalization, but that's after someone's already here and been here a while. So it doesn't really help us figure out who gets to come and what categories and what numbers and from where and all of that. So the U.S. Supreme Court has really looked at this, and they've implied a power in the federal government over immigration that's based on several other powers. So they say, well, the federal government has the power to, you know, make treaties and conduct war and make peace and various things like that. And that's related to foreigners being able to come or not come to the United States. And they also control international trade and business. And that's related to people coming in connection with international business. And so they said it makes sense to us that immigration should be a power exercised by the federal government, even though it's not expressly mentioned in the Constitution.
So federal government versus state by state, you're saying?
Right, exactly. And then within the federal government, it's kind of a shared power between Congress and the president.
And do the court systems kind of go back and forth in terms of who between the Congress and the president and his administration, his or her administration in the future, I should say, as well? Does it delineate case by case who gets to control what there? Because that seems to be where it's a little more nebulous.
No, the court really doesn't do that. It looks to the statutes that are passed by Congress. So we have a pretty comprehensive Immigration and Nationality Act that Congress passed, and it's, you know, amended many times over the years. And that sets forth some rules, but then it delegates a lot of authority to the president. And of course, he executes the law. That's part of being the chief executive officer for the country. And so he fills in those details. And there are specific types of authority that Congress has given him to carry out with respect to immigration.
What are some of those authorities? Can he determine which countries can allow immigrants to come here? Is it a matter of the method in which they're processed? I mean, what authority does a president really have?
Yeah, it really depends on the sub-area of immigration law. So, for example, one area where the president has a lot of authority and discretion is that he sets the number of refugees that come every year. And there's no number in the Constitution. There's really no guidance from Congress. Completely up to the president to decide how many refugees come. The Immigration and Nationality Act does have a non-discrimination clause in it, meaning that we're supposed to allow people from every country to come. But it also has a safety valve, which says that if there's a national emergency or the president determines it's not in the best interest of the country, he can limit people from certain countries. So he can act sort of in a discriminatory way and say, well, we're not going to let people from, I don't know, Russia in because, you know, we're punishing them for their war on Ukraine or something like that. So there are some national security provisions built in that give the president discretion.
Interesting. Okay, I got a lot to dive into just on those two points. First of all, I didn't realize that there was a set number by the president each year. Is that like signed on a piece of paper somewhere and then distributed to the border security? And when that number is hit, there's the big red light at the border? Like, how does that work? How does that play out?
Yeah, good question. So each October, the president will issue a presidential proclamation setting the number of refugees that he believes our country should accept that year. However, the law also allows him to adjust that number in response to emergency situations that develop. So lots of times at the beginning of the year, you don't know where there's going to be a hot spot around the world. And so, you know, that number can change later during the year. And yes, that is communicated to the various government agencies that deal with refugees. But I think when you and I spoke before, we talked about the difference between a refugee and an asylum seeker.
Mm-hmm.
A refugee is someone who's overseas, who is being persecuted and is seeking refuge in another country because they're afraid of their own country's government. An asylum seeker is somebody who's in the United States, who's also afraid of going home because of persecution, but they're already here. So it's two different categories of people.
So the president sets how many refugees can come, but the way asylum seekers are dealt with is a whole different thing, which you can go to WGNRadio.com and listen to our whole asylum seeker conversation we had with Professor Bies. So I guess just to recap, the refugee number is set. The asylum seeker number is a completely different thing. It's no, maybe there is no number.
There really isn't a number. And yes, it is a different thing. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so refugees, how do they... What, do they write a letter? Like, how do they say, I want to come? I want to be a refugee into the United States. My country is torn by war. Or is it, are there agencies on the ground in these areas where they've fled to that help process people to come?
Most of the time, they're going through the United Nations Office of High Commissioner for Refugees. And so they're initially being processed by the UN. And then when the UN says, yes, we think you probably qualify, we're going to try to find you a safe country to go to, they'll ask the United States, can you take people from this particular refugee camp, you know, from this part of the world? The U.S. will do its own investigation and vetting of the people and say yes or no, we'll take a certain number of people.
Do you happen to know that, and I'm putting you on the spot, and you can look it up during the news break, what the number kind of roughly is right now?
So the average is around 70,000 to 80,000 refugees a year. It went up quite a bit during the Obama administration to about 120,000. Then during the Trump administration, it went way down to like maybe 10,000, around that number. And now we're kind of back in that middle area again, 60,000, 70,000.
So when people hear, oh, well, we're in the middle area, there isn't any like influx of people coming in. No, we're talking about refugees. This has nothing to do with, really doesn't have anything to do with what we're seeing at the southern border. Those are two separate issues.
Correct.
Okay, just making sure I understand that. All right, so the president sets the refugee number. I forget what you said, the second power. I didn't even get to that one as my second question. What was the second power you mentioned the president had?
Well, the second power I was talking about was, you asked me, can the president just say, we don't want any people from a particular country to come? And the answer is yes, the president can say that. The general rule is that we don't discriminate based on nationality. But if there is a national emergency, our national interests are at stake, the president has the ability to change that. And you may remember during the Trump administration, President Trump issued what many people referred to colloquially as the travel bans on certain countries, where he said there were insufficient vetting procedures and there was a risk potentially of terrorists being able to slip through. And so he did ban people from about seven countries around the world because of those concerns. And there was a lawsuit about that, and it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And while the Supreme Court did require the executive to modify that order some, ultimately it said that the president had the power, you know, when the president believes it's in the national interest to, you know, limit people coming to the country, even if it's done on a discriminatory basis.
Right, because I think the crux of that was that the president, while running for election, had kind of promised a Muslim ban, quote unquote, and so people were filing lawsuits saying that these countries, I think it was seven that he picked, is cloaking perhaps a discrimination against religion, if I'm understanding how that debate went.
Yes, that was the crux of the argument, and ultimately the Supreme Court did not think that it was aimed just at Muslims or that it was discriminatory on the basis of religion. And they ultimately decided that the executive branch had sort of justified their concerns and that they had broad authority to do what they did under the immigration statute.
Okay. Got a couple questions on the text line. Someone said there is a set number for asylum seekers and that people are waiting up to 7 years for their cases to be heard. Maybe I'm reading the text wrong, and that often happens sometimes, or there's a word missing. I just want to recap. Refugees have a number that can, that's set in October, can be adjusted for different reasons. Asylum seekers are people that are already here, and the cases can be a long time for their cases to be heard. Ultimately, they have an initial case that's kind of heard immediately, and there's like a tentative outcome that comes out. But is there a number of asylum seekers, or is that up to a whole different process?
Again, that can vary, and it is a separate process from the refugee process. And with respect to sort of how they're handled, some people come on another type of visa. Maybe they come to visit as a tourist, or they come as a student, and then they apply for asylum after they're already here. Other people might be, you know, presenting themselves at the border, like this is what's happening a lot at the southern border. They show up at the southern border, and when they encounter the Customs and Border Protection agents, then they say, I want to seek asylum. I'm afraid to go back to my home country. And how they are handled has varied quite a bit in recent times, depending on what administration and what time we're at. I mean, the Biden administration has changed its mind a couple times already about how they're processing folks at the border. So that process has changed quite a bit. But your person who sent in the comment is correct that it is taking several years on average, about five right now, to have an asylum case fully heard and decided.
Fully heard, but there's been some sort of initial vetting.
Yes, normally they pass either what's called a credible fear or a reasonable fear interview if they're ones that are coming at the border. And so there's sort of an initial interview, and they make out what we lawyers might call a prima facie case. Basically, you know, it kind of hangs together. And then they're often allowed to come into the country and to live and to work while they're waiting for their proceeding to continue. Now, I will say that's a little bit of a change post-COVID. Pre-COVID, more asylum seekers were actually detained while being waiting for their hearings to go forward if they were picked up for being illegally present in the country. But now we're not detaining people as much as we were a few years ago.
Okay. So you could say that the president has a role in determining how asylum seekers are processed and how that process works. His administration can do that. Could a president say, we're not taking any asylum seekers?
Well, if he did, arguably that would violate our obligations. We belong to the Refugee Convention and international treaty. It doesn't require us to accept any set number of refugees, but we have committed to being part of that worldwide process. And we've been part of that refugee convention since at least 1980. And so, you know, that is something that we've committed to the international community, that we will take refugees, although we never set any particular number.
What about asylum seekers, though, like people crossing the border saying, I'm fleeing my country?
Yeah, so the Immigration and Nationality Act, which was passed by Congress, sets forth a process by which people have a right to seek asylum. They don't necessarily have a right to be granted. But arguably, if the president were to say, we're not taking any asylum seekers, that would be contrary to the Immigration and Nationality Act.
This is all complicated, Professor Bies.
Indeed.
Yeah, it is. No, I appreciate you breaking it down for us. It's important stuff. I want you to stay on the line. If you can you stay a little longer for us?
Yes, I can.
All right, more questions coming in on the text line. I've got a lot more questions. I'm really curious, any questions that you have, the listener, 312-981-7200. This is complicated when we talk about refugees versus asylum seekers, visas, people that cross legally, people that don't cross legally. There's a lot to dive into, but I think it's important for us to kind of like wrap our heads around the facts of these sorts of things so that when we enter political discussions and debates, which won't be today, that can be another day, I think it's important to have. I also want to ask Professor Baez about some comments that I heard at the Republican debate from the other night and see if ultimately a president has an authority to do any of those things. We'll get to that after this break in the news on Let's Get Legal here on WGN. WGN, continuing our chat with Professor Cindy Baez from the Southern Illinois University, all things immigration law. And we're getting a lot of great questions coming in. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. If you have any questions about immigration law. And all right, Cindy, here is one about asylum seeking. And in case you're just joining the conversation, we talked in the last half hour about how the president has the authority to set a number of refugees that come to this country every October. It can be adjusted, but he sets a number. And refugees are people that are not in the country right now seeking to come, often war-torn countries, or they just want out. They fear going back. Asylum seekers are people that are already here that are claiming that if they go back, they will be persecuted. Did I get that right, Cindy?
Yes, that's essentially correct.
Essentially. That's a great answer from a professor. Okay, I appreciate that. Okay, someone wanted to know, how many asylum seekers are granted asylum ultimately, or how many are denied? And I think what they're getting at is, do we have any idea of like percentages of people that ultimately are allowed to stay versus those that are said, well, that doesn't really fit what asylum is?
Yeah, the vast majority of people who claim asylum are denied asylum. The very high standard to meet, it's quite difficult to prove that you have a well-founded fear of persecution, and it has to be based on one of five categories: your race, your religion, your nationality, your political opinion, or your membership in a particular social group. So it can't be just that there's general war. You have to be sort of afraid of persecution, like you'll be targeted in some way. It can't be natural disaster, you know, bad economic conditions, that sort of thing. So it's a difficult standard to meet, and most people who claim asylum are not successful.
So you can't say, I'm going hungry in my country, me and my family will die if we go back there because there's no food?
Correct. That is not what asylum and refugee law is for.
Okay. So then, and this is my side question, although this texter has another great follow-up, is we see a lot of migrants in Chicago. They are here temporarily. They've passed that initial test. They're going to wait their court date. Some may be here for years, but the ultimate thing is very, and obviously you don't know individual cases, but the vast majority of those people will be denied and have to leave, even if they've established work, life, family here. I guess it changed if you get married, but generally speaking, a lot of them will ultimately go back to where they're from.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated because they have already passed their reasonable fear, credible fear interview. Their cases may be a little stronger than those who applied and were denied at that very initial stage. I suspect many of the people who are in Chicago or Illinois now also have been paroled into the country. We've had some special parole programs for people like from Afghanistan and Ukraine. And some of them may have stronger cases than from other places. They may have already gone through some initial processing for their parole program. However, there are definitely people who will be here for several years who will, you know, be working, going to school, putting down roots, and they will ultimately lose their case. And unless they have another path to stay lawfully, they will be told that they have to go back home.
Okay. So, and the same texter wanted to know, why is it taking so long in court?
Primarily lack of resources. Congress controls the budget, and Congress has not allocated enough funds to hire more judges, more attorneys, you know, everything that you need to have the proceedings, to have the hearings, to make the determinations.
Okay. This came up more in the last presidential election, but undoubtedly will continue here in 2024, next year. Does a president, this is from the 847, does a president have the ultimate authority to decide where to build a wall?
Yes, he has the authority with some caveats, though. As you probably know, there were a number of lawsuits. Some were brought by indigenous peoples who had claims to the land where the wall was being built. Some were brought by people concerned about the waterways or other landowners in the area where the government was building it, you know, on their land and harming businesses and farms and various things like that. So, yes, it's possible that the president could authorize the building of a wall. He also, though, needs money from Congress, and that's been a big sticking point, getting Congress to, you know, fund the wall. So there are a lot of caveats to that.
But the general authority is there if he can get Congress to fund it and theoretically work through some of the issues that you kind of mentioned, that, you know, to try and impede farming. Maybe there's another solution. But ultimately, the president can say, you know, if you'll give me the money, let's put up a border.
I would think that that would be the case. Again, it was partially litigated during the Trump administration, but when the administration came to an end, I think some of those lawsuits died, so we don't have a final answer.
Okay.
But the president is our commander-in-chief. He has the ultimate authority to protect our borders and to keep us safe, and so, you know, arguably the president has some discretion in how he does that and what he believes the threats to be and where they're coming from. And so, you know, it can be within his executive authority.
Okay. And like you said, we just sometimes don't have answers on these. They haven't made their way through the court system up to the Supreme Court for ultimate ruling. So we'll wait. This has come up from Governor DeSantis, who has proposed over the last couple months a host of immigration policies, including the idea of using deadly force against suspected drug traffickers and others breaking through open barriers. Can we shoot? And this is from the 312 with that. Can we shoot drug cartel members crossing the border and bringing in drugs?
Possibly. There's so many other facts we would have to know to really answer that question. So there's a lawyerly law professor answer for you. You know, they would have to be posing a danger. I mean, when you say suspected drug smugglers, what do we, like, how do we know that they are drug smugglers? And then the question would be, you know, are they carrying guns? Are they threatening the officers at the border?
Right.
Or, you know, are they unarmed? There are just lots of questions that we would have to know to answer that that question more fully.
And in theory, they'd have to already be on our side of the border, right? And it would be almost like a case-by-case thing. Like you're saying, yeah, if a drug smuggler is crossing the border and they are pointing a gun or firing a gun at a customs border agent, then, I mean, that you could see, obviously, someone wanting to respond and for their own protection. But I think the idea of just, like, shooting anyone that crosses the border that looks like they might have drugs on them would seem to be some violation, basically.
Yeah, you would need to have some better evidence of a threat than just that they're crossing the border and they look suspicious.
Right, and if you were to capture someone who had a drug on them, there would be a court process through that. You wouldn't then say, well, you're authorized to then shoot them on the spot after an investigation.
Right. I mean, you know, we're innocent until proven guilty in this country, even if we're not U.S. citizens.
Oh, really? That's an important point to make, that you get the due process of our law if you're in our borders, regardless if you're from here or not?
Yeah, so we often say that our Constitution is territorial. So if someone is in the United States physically, they are entitled to most constitutional protections.
Well, I think that would settle a lot of those discussions then. Okay. This has been in the news lately. This is a great question from the 773. Can individual states build borders, or, like in Texas, the floating barriers in the Rio Grande? Do states have the authority to say, we're trying to prevent people coming from in our state? They're obviously talking about Governor Greg Abbott.
Yeah, and so there was actually just a court decision a couple of days ago that said that Texas could not have that floating barrier in the Rio Grande. Now, it is a lower court decision that has not gone all the way up to the Supreme Court, but the initial legal ruling from a Texas court was that the state could not do that in the way that they had done it. So we don't fully know the answer to that, but initial indications are that it's probably not within the state's purview to do that.
And that goes back to where we kind of started the conversation, that this isn't in the Constitution, but generally speaking, immigration law has been deemed to be in the hands of the federal government, not the state of Texas.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. More questions are coming in. Thank you for giving so much of your time, Professor Bies. I'm going to steal a little bit more of it. We're going to take a break here. Any other questions you have, 312-981-7200 on immigration law. Professor Bies is an expert at this and always willing to answer your questions. We'll do it after this on WGN. But we get a bonus half hour today, and Karen Conti is going to be here after the 3 o'clock news to answer a lot of questions and talk through some big legal stories in the news. Cindy Bies, though, so gracious to spend a big chunk of her afternoon with us here on WGN, professor of law at Southern Illinois University. And Cindy, we got more questions. You ready for a couple more?
Sure.
Okay. And I was texting you this question to prep for it a little bit. Someone wanted to know, and this was regarding what we were talking about with Ron DeSantis and a few other folks at the Republican debate, saying that they would send the military down there. And essentially, they're wondering, could you shut down a border? Could a president say, this is a threat? Anyone coming from Mexico is a threat to our well-being, whether it's fentanyl or something, and saying, no one crosses.
So theoretically, yes. We talked about the fact that the president is commander-in-chief, and he has the duty to defend the nation from foreign threats. And so theoretically, the president could do what he felt necessary as commander-in-chief. There are some federal statutes that limit the use of federal troops in certain places and in certain ways, and I'm not an expert on the military law. But I know that issue has come up sometimes when proposals have been floated about, using federal troops at the border. And there are some limitations on that Congress has placed by statute. However, again, it depends on the kind of threat, what the president believes is in the best interest of the country in his role as commander-in-chief. You know, right now we've seen a significant decline in people coming across the border over the last few months due to what a lot of people refer to as the Remain in Mexico policy. So right now, if you're coming from another country through Mexico and presenting yourself at the southern border, there are a lot of restrictions on your ability to claim asylum in the United States. You have to make an appointment now on this new app that the government has, the CBP One app, and then wait till you have your appointment date. And it limits sort of the number of people who can come, you know, particularly from certain countries. And, you know, it's been done through an agreement with Mexico, where Mexico agrees to do a better job of monitoring what's happening of people coming through and then also sending people back who, you know, we don't allow to come into the United States. So it does have some issues. I've heard many reports that people are having trouble accessing the app. There aren't enough appointments, you know, all kinds of things like that. But, you know, for those who are trying to, you know, bring down the numbers coming to the border, it does seem to be succeeding in doing that.
Okay. Some would argue, and this is not me making this point, they will say, well, so many people rushed to the border before the expiration of Title 42 that so many already crossed in that that's why the numbers are lower. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, and that's not for today. That can be another discussion. 847 had an interesting question. It's kind of loaded. The idea is, why don't more people try to come through the country, to the country, through legal means? Or is it really that difficult to come to the United States? Is this process just way too hard? And I know that's sort of in political sphere, which I'm not trying to guide you towards, Professor Bies, but just generally speaking, if someone wants to live here because they just want to seek a better life, they're not afraid of being persecuted back at home, they're not a refugee from a foreign war, like, what is that process like right now? Is there a way to do it?
It is really hard, in part because demand so far exceeds supply. So, you know, in general, we have 675,000 visas that we give out for people to become lawful permanent residents each year. The majority of those visas, 480,000, are allocated to people who have family here who are coming to join certain close family members. So that takes out the big bulk. So if you don't already have the right relationship with a family member in the United States, makes it very difficult. The next largest group, 140, is for people who have work visas. Again, that's only 140,000 a year, not that big a number. And then we have another, you know, 50,000 that we give out to a program called Diversity Immigrants. But, you know, it's just the numbers get increasingly smaller, so it's just not that many. And so there are many, many of those categories are horribly backlogged. You know, if you are the brother or sister of someone from a country like Mexico or China or India, where there's been a lot of immigration, it's going to be a decade or two probably before you can come to the United States lawfully when you are sponsored by your sibling.
Wow. And that's if you have someone here already.
Yes. Yeah, so that's if you have someone here already. So if you're just someone who says, hey, you know what? I'm educated, I'm skilled, I'm a hard worker, I want to go seek a better life. If you don't have a connection with someone to be your sponsor, it's almost impossible.
Wow. Is there any evidence that when maybe you allow more people to come in through legally, I don't know if there's been a time in our country where we did that, that illegal immigration goes down, meaning that if there are avenues for quicker ways to get in through legal means, that the illegal means or the legal passages go down a little bit, or is there not really much data on that?
So, you know, the first 100 or more, even more years of our country, we really didn't have much in the way of immigration controls. We wanted people to come. We wanted them to come and settle the new lands and help build the new country and all of that. And so we did have our doors pretty much wide open through most of like the 1800s. And we started to become more restrictive around the turn of the century, around, you know, 1900. In part because we were starting to feel like, okay, now, you know, there's such large numbers coming and, you know, they aren't always educated or speaking the language or that sort of thing. And so maybe we need to slow it down a little bit more. And of course, there have been themes of racism and xenophobia throughout our history as well. So we've definitely gotten more restrictive over time. But in terms of, yes, I mean, if you have more pathways for people to do it legally, most people would prefer to do it legally and not right. sort of live in the shadows and be afraid all the time of being caught.
Yeah. And I feel like the vast majority of these people, when you poll them, want more avenues for legal immigration, including business leaders, religious leaders, all sorts of things. There just has not been quite the will in Congress to come to bipartisanship agreements. I'm going to leave that for another day. We just opened up a whole other can of worms that we don't have time for. Professor Bies, yeah. Law professor at the Southern Illinois University, thank you so much for your time. I always appreciate it. Okay.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.